content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from our state magazine. Today's reading of our state is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving our community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 15 years. Thank you, Carter Glass. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now it's time to return once again to the November 2022 edition of our state magazine celebrating North Carolina. Beautiful picture of a dog here, a Plotts Hound. And they're going to talk about a pirate's life. We're in the middle of the photo essay. We are going to read it. We didn't quite finish it last week, so we're going to finish that. Carolina Born and Bred. And there's something under the label here. I should have peeled it off before. Let's see if I can peel it quickly. It says, Carolina Born and Bred, seven stories of our state animals. Do you know what they are? The gray squirrel, the honeybee, the cardinal, the channel bass, a Spanish mustang, and box turtle, and then it says, and more. So we'll see how much we can get to. We're going to continue now with the end of the pictorial, which was a lot of words and a modest amount of pictures and words combined here. This double page spread is entitled Pillage and Plunder in Swansboro. And this sort of stuff really interests me because I've been to many of these places on the Carolina coast. I love it out on the Carolina coast. Not so familiar with the western part of the state, but I love to read about it. Anyway, this is Swansboro. The boom of cannon fire reverberates across downtown Swansboro as pirates invade Front Street during Pirate Fest each May. While musical group The Motley Tones roams the event, singing sea shanties, the Mecca 2, a replica of a 17th century pirate brigantine. Do you know what a brigantine is? Neither do I. Patrols the harbor. Anywhere from 3,000 to 6,000 attendees can watch unchoreographed sword fighting demonstrations or learn to fight with a cutlass, tie knots, or fish using 18th century methods. Kids shoot a cannon with a foam ball or complete a scavenger hunt for prizes like pirate treasure. It's such an interactive event. Anna Stanley, director for Swansboro Parks and Recreation, says of the joint effort between the city and Onslow County Parks and Rec, which created Pirate Fest, I love seeing everybody dressed up and having fun, she says. Double page spread here. Caption first, at Pirate Fest each year, Captain Horatio Sinbad, I wonder if that's his real name, who has lived aboard his 54-foot brigantine, Mecca 2, shown here, continuously for more than 50 years, leads a mock attack on Swansboro. Now, I know brigantine refers to a certain style of boat. This boat has a white sides to it, and then a black gunwale on it, and below it there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 portholes. They almost look like they could be places where cannons might come out rather than visitors would peek out. There are two masks on the brigantine. That's not a complete definition of a brigantine, I'm sure. And there is a lifeboat hung to the rear and a pirate's mask. It actually looks like a black flag with a white skeleton on it. And you can go way out on the bow on some sort of a bowsprit with railings around it. Well, around not how to get there, but when you get all of the end, once you get there, you can get a little bit of extra support. And there's some sort of a pirate's flag way atop one of the masts. And, of course, we have the beautiful downtown buildings and a few docks there in Swansboro. Overleaf now, I see a sign which says, Edward Teach, notorious pirate called Blackbeard, lived in Bath while Charles Eden was governor, killed at Ocracoke in 1718. I do remember seeing that sign in person. And there's a white house with a picket fence around it, and then a nice air view of this is part of the waterways around Bath. The caption says, legend has it that the Bonner family, who lived in the house on the top left across from Blackbeard's home on Plum Point, which is to the right of the boat here, would see a ball of fire the size of a man's head while sailing around on stormy nights. I have a friend who lived right in this area, but supposedly right on that road where Plum Point is. The sort of brownish water comes in from the lower left and goes off to the center, and it splits in two creeks, one off to the right-hand side. And when it does, there's a bunch of houses around there and some docks in that area. And some of the area is manicured in green, whereas everything else is heavily forested, although some of that forested area is clearly planted because everything is trimmed to the same height. So I don't know what that might be right there. It says, land ho! After running the Queen Anne's Revenge aground in what is now known as Beaufort Inlet in 1718, Blackbeard sailed to the port of Bath, where he accepted a pardon from Governor Charles Eden and settled down. Many believe that he took up residence in a home on Plum Point and married his 14th bride here. I wonder what happened to the first 13. But the adventurous buccaneer could not be satisfied with the life of a land-dwelling law-abider. Just a few months after accepting his pardon, he took up pirating again, bringing his spoils back to Bath. And in a page appropriately entitled, Final Port of Call, Ocracoke, Captain Rob Temple sails the Windfall II, his schooner, an antique type of sailing vessel with two masts that became popular around 1712, in much the same way that pirates sailed the 18th century. He aims the boat into the wind, hoists the sail, and heads out of Ocracoke's Silver Lake Harbor into Pamlico Sound. As he sails past Teach's Hole, a part of the sound just south of the village, where Blackbeard was anchored in the months leading up to his death, Temple tells passengers about the notorious pirate's final battle, in which he was beheaded by Lieutenant Robert Maynard of the British Royal Navy in November 1718. Legend has it that after the pirate's body was thrown overboard, it swam seven times around the ship before finally sinking. There's a website, schoonerwindfall.com. Pictures, there's a lot more fantasy than known fact about Blackbeard, says Captain Rob Temple. Painter Jean-Léon Jérôme Ferris imagined the infamous pirate's last stand in capture of the pirate Blackbeard, 1718. And in this particular moment, Blackbeard, we presume, is standing, and he has his sword behind his head about to swing it, but I guess the person who supposedly beheaded him or shot him is in front of him. Not clear what's going to happen at this moment, although there is a man on the ground that is pointing his gun directly at Blackbeard. So maybe he got shot first and beheaded next. Beautiful picture of the boat on the water, sun setting behind. The sky is orange. It's so orange that the water appears orange also as the sun is about to set below the horizon. Well, that ends the pictorial, so we're going to move on to a series of short articles, I think. It starts out with this title, Drink Up, Me Hearties! Across the state, businesses celebrate our pirate history with drinks like Blackbeard's Breakfast, a pecan honey rum cocktail at Outer Banks Distilling in Manteo, or the Pirate's Golden Ale at Mooresville's Jolly Roger Brewery, named for the traditional pirate's flag. In Jarvisburg, Sanctuary Vineyards red muscadine wine, The Plank, features a depiction of Blackbeard on its label, while Edward Teach Brewery in Wilmington sports what many believe to have been the pirate's real name. Blackbeard and his crew frequented the waters off our coasts hundreds of years ago, but the buccaneering spirit lives on in the hearts of North Carolinians everywhere. To us, these swashbuckling seafarers have taken on legendary status, their rebellious nature continuing to inspire a thirst for adventure. We see somebody sitting here at Edward Teach Brewery. Man and woman sitting at the end of a pointed bar. It's an unusual bar. It's it's kind of shaped like a boat, actually. And this is, they're sitting at what would be the bow of it. And then there's Outer Banks Distillery with their Kill Devil Rum. And then a picture of the Sanctuary Vineyards at sunset. And on the right-hand page, Pirate's Landing, a steak and seafood restaurant in Elkin, was built to resemble a pirate ship, from the masts rising above the roof to the cannons stationed inside. So we see masts coming up from the peaks of the roof. Well, we are on to a North Carolina Thanksgiving, a meaningful meal for those in need, memories of holidays past, and a festive parade that brings people together. Thanksgiving traditions remind us that there's so much to be grateful for. A gracious plenty. For more than 30 years, residents of Greensboro have looked forward to one special Thursday in November. Simpler than Thanksgiving, but every bit as meaningful. At the Feast of Caring, the community comes together over bread, soup, handmade pottery, and a good cause. Written by Susan Stafford Kelly. Wherever archaeologists unearth artifacts from centuries past, there are nearly always bowls. Because surely, not long after man discovered fire, someone took a handful of mud, shaped it, and placed it beside the flames to harden. Throughout history, immigrants and explorers, pioneers and cowboys, carried few belongings on their treks, but there was always a bowl. 3 decades ago, potters Teresa Boone and Stacy Carson proposed an idea to Mike Aitken, the then director, executive director, of Greensboro Urban Ministry, otherwise known as GUM, G-U-M, rather than asking outright for funds to feed the hungry, why not invite the community to a feast that ultimately feeds those in need? Boone and Carson would encourage their potter pals to create and donate handcrafted bowls, a symbol of sharing, as a gift to participants. And what better time to schedule the event than at Thanksgiving, a holiday centered on food and gratitude. 31 years later, and always on the Thursday before Thanksgiving, the Urban Ministry's Feast of Caring draws hundreds of diners to First Baptist Church in Greensboro. Patrons can purchase advance tickets online. $30 is the suggested donation, or simply show up at the door. The enthusiastic response motivated the organization some years ago to include lunch service as well as dinner, and lines form early. I think people come early because they want first choice of the pottery, Cheryl Ledford, GUM's director of special events, says with a laugh. And what a choice! The display of available goods occupies an entire room. Varied as the potters themselves, hailing from Seagrove and locally, the bowls inside the pottery room range in hues from blues to greens to yellows and rusts. They're speckled and tricolored, textured or glossy and smooth, mug-shaped with handles or folded and veined to resemble leaves. All are etched on the bottom with artist's initials or the letter FOC for Feast of Caring. Rather than getting a bowl, patrons can opt for 6 honor cards designed annually by artist William Mangum, indicating a donation to Urban Ministry to give his presence during the holidays. Mangum has donated his time and artistic talents to GUM through donor holiday cards even longer than the Feast of Caring has been in existence. Still, the feast is the thing, after all. All bowls in hand Folks enter the large fellowship hall filled with round tables and stations of soups and breads. Up to a dozen varieties of soups and big kettles are on offer. From Senegalese chicken soup, an annual favorite, created by an urban ministry chef who was himself a one-time client of the organization, to matzo ball soup stirred up by cooks from Temple Emmanuel. There's also tomato bisque, vegetable beef, potato leek, and chicken and rice, all prepared and donated by area restaurants or individuals. There's no limit on the portions served in disposable bowls by volunteers. Feel free to sample a bit of everything. And don't forget your bread selection, from corn muffins to challah, trusset rolls to popovers, all donated by churches, Temple Emmanuel, and local bakeries. One office brings its staff for lunch. Families come for dinner. Sunday school classes gather and individuals drift in, joining strangers and greeting friends while marveling over the variety of food, pottery, and people. Has the soup ever run out? We've come down to the wire, Ledford says, bringing to mind the miracle of loaves and fishes. I don't want to leave, adds Christine Ringret, GUM's communication and marketing director. You'll see their bowls stacking up on the table. They're urging each other, taste this, taste this one. Local music makers, including saxophonist Wally West, along with Dr. Bobby Doolittle and Jim Carson, who've been playing to the crowd for decades, take to the stage for entertainment, and both a pastor and a rabbi give thanks. The scene is leisurely, lively, casual, congenial, and yet somehow profoundly moving. The Feast of Caring is a fundraiser for those experiencing food insecurity, yes, but it's also a people raiser, says Myron Wilkins, GUM's former executive director, to make people aware that the community right in your own neighborhood is struggling for food. What you're eating, soup and a piece of bread, might be the only meal someone nearby has had all day. Wendy Apple, a member of the Greensboro Women's Club, which has been volunteering at the event for years, offers another perspective. For me, this is what begins the true meaning of Thanksgiving and Christmas. Giving back, she says. There's a beautiful mix of community in need and not, coming together at tables, and everybody is welcome. It's not about your station in life or your faith practices. It's all about reaching across the table and getting to know your neighbor and sharing a bowl of soup. The handcrafted bowls aren't just for one season either. People have collections gathered over years of attendance. My family loves soup night because I put out all the different bowls from years past, and they pick theirs, another Women's Club member explains. For chowder and chili, these are bowls just right for peanuts or peppermints, olives or oyster crackers, salsa or sugar, bowls for sharing with others, for giving to others. Every year, Ledford begins planning the Feast of Caring long before November. She estimates that more than 100 volunteers are behind a typical day of feeding 700 diners. It takes a lot of people to shape and fire and ship, to chop and slice and simmer, to set up and serve and clean. But oh, the mere hours when the event takes place on a single day serves so many more. The humble meal of two basic elements, soup and bread, allows us to connect with a feeling of deprivation some GUM guests know well, Ringret says. It reminds us that in a week's time we'll be sitting down at a big table of food and others won't. So the music plays on, the ladies keep lifting, the tables fill, empty, and fill again, just as the bowls do. The simplest of implements, filled with uncomplicated ingredients, nevertheless yields a feast, one that feeds the body, warms the soul, and inspires gratitude in donors and diners long after the season and the soup is finished. The Feast of Caring at First Baptist Church is November 17th, 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. and 5 to 7 at 1000 West Friendly Avenue in Greensboro. GreensboroUrbanMinistry.com. And now, How about Thanksgiving Revisited? Here's an old-time picture. We can tell for a number of reasons. It's a black and white or perhaps sepia tone picture. You can look at the clothes on the people and even the glass frames on the woman at the end of the table, the haircuts on the boys, and the and the particular tablecloth that's there, which is a checkered one, and say, yep, this is an oldie picture. 1964! Yeah, and well, let's read the head. Let's read the little heading first here. It says, Thanksgiving Revisited. Over the years, a lot has changed about how we celebrate Thanksgiving, but certain traditions, gatherings of family and friends, football in the backyard, and turkey on the table have stood the test of time. So this picture is from 1964. A little older than the oldest of the three children, or four children, that are shown here, with Papa and Mama and maybe a much older sister in the background. Not sure who she is. Thanksgiving at the Smith family home. In the mid-60s, a family of 11, like that of Forsyth County residents Clay and Bernice Smith, pictured here with five of their nine children, Gary, Gloria, Jean, Karen, Denny, and Norris would have paid about $11.65 for their entire Thanksgiving meal, compared to an average of $77.52 today. Going to go back older here. 1939, going twice, sold. During the first half of the 20th century, farmers from across the region flocked to Durham's Warehouse District for the fall tobacco auction season. Local stores often held big sales to capitalize on the influx of farmers who now had cash to spend and time to spare. Outside the auction warehouses, they could buy products like socks, shoes, scarves, ties, tablecloths, medicines, produce, and livestock, including around Thanksgiving, live turkeys. And here they are, loaded in cages in the back of a rickety-looking wagon with wheels that are a lot thinner than the ones we would use today. And, of course, every man has a coat and a hat on, as they would back in 1939. Now, here we are in 1943. A roadside feast. These Marines from Camp Lejeune's Motor Transport School in Jacksonville may not have been able to celebrate the holidays with their families, but they were still treated to a full Thanksgiving dinner. While in the field for truck driving and combat training, they took a break to enjoy the bird of the season and accessories of the roadside. The base had just been established 2 years earlier in response to the United States' need for an amphibious training facility on the East Coast during World War II. Circa 1955, Raleigh rings in the holiday season. Every year since 1945, the Saturday before Thanksgiving has been reserved for Raleigh's Christmas parade. The event actually began in 1939 as a way for merchants to give back to the community and to encourage locals to get a head start in their holiday shopping. But it was put on hold for several years during World War II. By the 1950s, the parade had become a beloved family tradition. As the years went on, floats, balloons, and performances became bigger and more elaborate. Today, about 80,000 spectators line Fayetteville Street as the procession heads east toward the state capitol. Black and white photo again. I was not in Raleigh in 1955. There's a big sign at the back that says Best Values, and then I can't quite read. It looks like it says C. Rawls, R-A-W-L-S, so that will be meaningful to some of you. And then there's a big Pine State sign, and I know what that refers to. The word milk is underneath it. And there is a marching band coming down the street with some majorettes and a man, of course, leading the majorettes at that time. And I did not describe the picture for the roadside feast in 1943. The men are all in uniform. They have on their army caps, and every one of them has got something in their hands. The man on the end here is biting off of a chicken, or rather probably a turkey wing, and he has, looks like a, what do you call it, styrofoam plate on his lap. And each one of the men, they're sitting on a little unkempt grassy area, which has fallen off. It just drops off into a muddy area. So like maybe it was a creek and it was eroded up to that point, but it's fine for them to sit and their feet are just the right distance down into the solid mud pack below. Football and fellowship. On band day, or rather for band day, at Wake Forest University's football game against University of Virginia on the Saturday before Thanksgiving in 1972, the marching band gave a special holiday greeting to the spectators at Groves Stadium, now BB&T Field. Not long ago, that's interesting, BB&T, now they've been bought by Truist. I wonder if they had to change the name. I digress. Not long after the band was formed in 1927, the Old Gold and Black wrote that it was, quote, the only organization of its kind in the state which combines marching formations and letter formations as part of its program given at football games in the fall. This is a view from on high. I'm not going to say it's aerial view because I'm sure they didn't have drones back then. It's probably somebody up in the announcer's booth taking a picture. You can see the stadium's, maybe three-quarter full on both sides. And on the field, all of the marchers have formed out the letters Happy Thanksgiving. And now we're down to 1972. Let's talk turkey. In 1970, North Carolina was ranked third in the nation for turkey production. By 1981, it would move up to first. Most of the state's turkey farms, like this one in Goldsboro, are still concentrated in the southern Piedmont and coastal plain. Goldsboro Milling Company began in 1916 as a feed mill, and in 1958 it turned its attention to raising turkeys. In the mid-1980s, the company joined with Carroll's Foods, later Smithfield Foods, to form Carolina Turkeys, which eventually became Butterball, a brand now seen on Thanksgiving tables across the country. And 1951, yes, that's a 1951 oven that I see there. Like mother, like daughter, George and Beth Pascal and their family celebrated one of their first holidays at their new home in 1951. Designed by modernist architect James Fitzgibbon, the house featured expansive windows for ventilation and heated floors and a sunken fireplace to keep warm in the winter. In the kitchen, Beth prepared the Thanksgiving turkey while her daughter, Laura Huston, tended to the partridge in her own miniature oven. Kind of an unusual oven. I've never actually seen one like that. You can see the sides. It kind of sticks out almost like it's sitting on top of the countertop. There seem to be just three controls underneath. One looks like an on-off switch. And then there's some kind of a switch with a black handle, and then one with a white, which I think is the temperature control. She's got the turkey out on the open oven door, and her daughter, who has a cute little apron on, is reaching into her own little mini oven set, which has been set, at least for purposes of this picture, on a little table in front of some other component of the kitchen. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you enjoyed it enough that you'll come back to listen again next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving our community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments, questions, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.